So we were discussing Munisutta. As we know, Munisutta is one of the interesting suttas available in the Suttanipata, where Buddha explained various aspects of the Muni, various aspects of the enlightened person, fully enlightened person. Or sometimes it is referred to the Buddha himself. What are the very interesting spiritual qualities of the Buddha himself? So those are briefly highlighted in this particular sutta. So we were going by verse by verse. So these whole suttas, mostly in the Suttanipata, are compiled as verses, but that verse is quite deep and fairly concise. So the teaching is very concisely included in a particular verse, and therefore we need to do a little bit of drilling down in order to understand its content. Now, we were discussing last week this one, that is, Yogāhane Pamborivā Vivajāyati Yasmin Pare Vācā Pariyantaṁ Vadanti. So basically, these things represent certain amount of practical applications of one's qualities. Now here, when one's mind is quite steadfast, strong, steady, but still one may be going through various ups and downs of life, various vicissitudes of life, but the interesting point is this particular Muni, the enlightened person, is unwavering. So he is capable of maintaining a kind of a firm steadiness within oneself. And today also we can discuss the other two more verses. So it is going like this. Yo sanyatato na karoti papam. Yo sanyatato na karoti papam. Dharocha majjimocha muni yo tattu. Ya tattu. Arosaneyo na soroseti kanchi tangvapidhira muni vedayanti. Now here again, how he is behaving with others, how he is dealing with others, how a Muni, how the Buddha is dealing with others is represented here. Yo sanyatattu na karoti papam. So he is a well-restrained person. He has a very good self-control. So he is not impulsively reacting. Actually, in order to have this quality, we don't need to say that one essentially needs to be an arahant. Even when one is developing mindfulness to some extent, slowly these kind of qualities start to start to generate within oneself. So previously, before one develops mindfulness, one may be acting impulsively, or one may be immediately impulsively reacting. But slowly, as mindfulness develops, so that reaction become less and less, and instead he may be doing a wise reflection before he act, and then he may be doing an appropriate response. Not impulsive reaction, but an appropriate response, we can say. So likewise, there's a kind of a self-control going to happen, and that is very much indicated in everywhere. Not in the bodily actions, but also in the verbal and mental activities. So yo sanyatattva na karoti papam. So as a result of that, he is not engaged in various unwholesome activities. So these qualities themselves have a kind of a purification effect on one's mind. That is why Buddha mentioned mindfulness as a gatekeeper. So a gatekeeper has to be a wise person, and he knows whom that he has to allow to go in and whom he has not to allow to go in. So that indicates that he has to check, he has to verify who is going to go in, and he has to verify who is not going to go in, he need to prevent, avoid going in. So that verification is one of the tasks of that gatekeeper. So in the good old days, so he is a wise person, and again he is a person with sort of a good memory. because he know exactly this person is a internal inside person, he's a valid person, a civilian. But there may be disguised people or maybe enemies, and he has to be quite wise in order to recognize them properly. Therefore, the white gatekeeper has that capacity. Similarly, Buddha mentioned the mindfulness has such capacity. So when one is developing mindfulness, so mindfulness takes care what is going on within the mind, whether it is beneficial or harmful, and accordingly it may take a proper action. So if it is a harmful type of thought probably, so one can slowly abandon that. And if it is a somewhat beneficial or wholesome thought, probably he can maintain. Or sometimes if he'll prefer, he can even keep his attention onto the kind of emptiness or unattached nature of the mind in case he is capable of doing that. So likewise, so mindfulness do such kind of a purification effect. So put the mention, sati dovariko bhikkave arya savako savajjam pajahati aravajjam bhaveti suddham attanam pariharati. So mindfulness as a gatekeeper, so he keep on abandoning the unwholesome states and keep on developing the wholesome states, and as a result of that one becomes more and more purified. So similarly here, as one is becoming more and more restrained, developed with mindfulness, so sati samvara is another aspect that the, as a result of the mindfulness development, there is a kind of a restraint, inner restraint going to be developed, happen. Now one becomes more and more purified, considerate person. Daharocha majjimocha muni yatattu. Now this doesn't mean that the person, the muni, has to be a very old person. There may be young munis as well. So that's a very interesting point here. So even during the Buddha's time, there are young arahants. So there are Sunita, there are Sopaka, there are Pandita Samanera. So likewise, there's a series of names, and even Venerable Rahula. So likewise, there's a series of names quite familiar, and some are arahants. Actually, Venerable Rahula became an arahant after 20 years or something. But Sopaka, Sunita, and Pandita Samanera, Sumana Samanera. So likewise, there are a series of certain Samaneras. Even though they, from their age, they are young, but they are very powerful arahants. So therefore, there is no such age gap or age differences. If one is developing it properly, if one is dedicating oneself, practice properly, then there's a potential to become an arahant. So here this particular sutta is talking about them. So therefore, even there is no age difference. If a person is a muni, if a person is a enlightened, fully enlightened person, even though he is from his age, he is young, still he has the same qualities, same spiritual qualities. So there may be an old person who also be an arahant, so he also has the same qualities. So that's a very interesting phenomena. So when mind has completely purified, so that age differences, caste differences, so all become nullified, all become invalid. So once spiritual qualities are in full operation, and as a result of that, one is quite capable. Arosaneyo na so roseti kanchi. Now here, he doesn't blame another person or criticize another person, and he himself is blameless. So no one else is basically blaming him, or there may be blames, but he is basically blameless person. Now even to the Buddha, sometimes people come and blame or use harsh words. But in general, we know that who is Buddha and how much the whole world is benefited. In general, therefore, he is a praiseworthy person. He's not someone blameworthy. He's a blameless person. And similarly, he doesn't blame another. doesn't use harsh words. So there's these two sides mentioned here. He does not scold anyone, and others also don't scold him. So he's maintaining that proper conduct. Tangvapi dhira muni vedayanti. So he's the real muni, he's the real enlightened being that the wise people are pointing out. Now here also we can understand how he's maintaining his conduct. So we can't say that one becomes completely insane when one becomes a arahant and he completely ignore all the ethics, all the conventions, or all the social norms. He may understand that there is no value in them, there is nothing substantial in them. They are only useful for the well-being of the society, and he may respect that. Accordingly, he may act, accordingly he may behave, knowingly they are merely conditions, conventions, but he may have a certain consideration because he too is living in the same society. So likewise, certain interesting dialogues have happened during the Buddha's time, and sometimes people are, or even celestial beings are coming and asking from the Buddha how an arahant is using the typical conventional language. And sometimes they refer, I am preaching, they gave something to me. So likewise, I, me, mine, myself. So those terminologies are being used by even arahants. So certain devas came to Buddha and they asked why they are referring like that. Is there any kind of asmimana, a self-view remaining within them? Is it because of that they are referring like that? So likewise, certain devas actually asked from the Buddha, and then Buddha mentioned, it's not so. They are merely using a convention, a language, knowing its limitations, knowing that it is not something substantial, and knowing that what is referred have nothing substantial. So likewise, it's a very interesting area, how one is respecting the social norms, ethics, etc., but at the same time, even using that, but at the same time, internally he know very well, is a merely convention. And then we can get into the next verse. Yadaggato majjato sesato va pindang labeta paradattu pajivi nalang tuthung nopi nipachyavadi tangvapi dhira muni vedayanti. So this is a very, very interesting verse. Yadaggato majjato sesato va pindang labeta paradattu pajivi nalang tuthung nopi nipachyavadi tangvapi dhira muni vedayanti. Now this is a mendicant monk, maybe the Buddha, maybe another noble person who is simply going through the alms round, and he is ready to receive from any portion. So that means sometimes people maybe give from the very best food, whatever the best, most delicious food what they have, probably they may offer to him. Sometimes they may give something moderate. And sometimes even people may give what is going to be thrown. So they don't have much respect, they don't have much faith. Probably they don't have much really something, say, fresh to offer. What they have is certain stale food. Even that probably they can offer. But the muni, the monk, is ready to accept. So how beautifully Buddha mentioned it is, referring the rice pot. People may be taking it from the top and offering it. Maybe they are taking lump of food or rice from the middle. Or sometimes they may be even take it from the bottom. So the muni is not making any distinction. He is ready to accept irrespective of where it is being offered. So similarly, we can say in broader sense, so either they offer something delicious, something say worthy, something useful, or even if they give something moderate, or even they simply neglectfully to something which they are going to throw away. In all these cases, the Muni, the fully enlightened being, is maintaining his very moderate or kind of even-minded attitude. He is not going to praise, over-praise or over-appreciate to the person who has given the most delicious food. Or even he is not going to appreciate or sort of hint a person who has given a moderate food. And similarly, he is not going to refuse or blame the person who has given carelessly or given the most rough or undelicious type of food. Because he is capable of accepting whatever it is. This is a very, very interesting point here. And then, Pindang Labeta Paradattupajivi. Now here Buddha mentioned this monk is like a Paradattupajivi ghost. Paradattupajivi is a ghostly realm where they fully depend on someone else's merit. So they have their own life, but they can actually anumodana, they can actually rejoice from someone else's merit. As a result of that, they are growing themselves, or they are sort of maintaining their well-being. That is the most popular ghostly realm, which is indicated in the Dhamma, which are fully dependent on the merit. That's why, for example, after we conduct a good activity, a meritorious deed, so when we are sharing merits, particularly the beings who are in this particular state, the Paratattupajivi, so they are capable of receiving those merits, and they rejoice in those merits, and again, they may benefit from those merits. But there may be certain other ghostly realms, in which they can't do it. They are not capable of doing that. And there may be certain, human beings, they can't do it. Even though someone else, they are previous children. Suppose now they are giving a large dana at a particular place. The person, the mother, father already passed away and he is now reborn in another place as a human being. So he is not aware of what his previous children are doing. On such situation, he can't actually make a very good anumodana, very good rejoice, because he don't know. But in contrary, in opposite, so this Paradattupajivi is something, this ghostly realm, so they are fully capable of accepting someone else's merit, and they are really benefiting from that. So the point here Buddha highlights is that the mendicant monk is like that. So whatever offered, so they are ready to accept. They don't have any distinction. Either they are rich people, either they are middlings, or either they are poor people. They don't care about that. So the mendicant monk may be going one house to the other without skipping any house. He's not only selectively going only to the rich houses, but he even go to the biggest place. He even go to a poorest man's place. And he actually, by going so, he is showing his compassion towards that people, because such, poor people, they can't offer a full-fledged dana, an almsgiving to the whole set of monks. So what they can simply offer is this kind of a very simple thing. So once a monk approach their home, so they may be taking from what they are going to eat. They may have prepared some food only for their own consumption. Now a monk is approaching, so they are taking a little bit from that food, and now they are offering to that particular monk. So that may be the only thing they could offer, they could afford. So the monk is giving that very beautiful opportunity for them. So therefore, certain monks are there, so they deliberately go to the poor houses. Especially we can see that in the Venerable Mahakassapa's character. So Venerable Mahakassapa is a very prominent arahant. So especially when he is emerged from the Nirodha Samapatti, he is specially seeking who are the most underprivileged or most poor people available right now. by simply going to their houses, if they even offer me a little bit, immediately they will get the results. So he actually wants to help them. He actually wants to give them the opportunity. So he simply has gone to those places and simply keep waiting till they see him, and then they are coming and offering it. And there are very interesting such situation. Actually, there is one occasion Venerable Mahakassapa was offered by a leper who is in a terrible condition. And that leper being a beggar, so he actually had some food. So Venerable Kassapa has approached to him. And when this leper is actually offering food to Venerable Kassapa, actually one of his fingers has dropped to the bowl. This very interesting situation recorded in the Theragatha. So Venerable Mahakassapa is telling, so when this leper offered some food to Venerable Kassapa's bowl, so that one finger was dropped from that leper's hand. But Venerable Mahakassapa mentioned, so I didn't have any kind of regret, any kind of an irritation. I had the same amount of compassion towards that particular person. I simply kept that finger away and I ate the food. So you can imagine what the features of the Arahant. So they are even in the level of arms round. They have these very, very interesting, very high standards. And Buddha, even sometimes when he is going to village Pindapatha, sometimes even the Mara come and disturb him. There are such situations. So Mara is always trying to hinder the Buddha. So sometimes Mara come early to that particular village and he prevent all the villagers from giving anything to the Buddha. And on such situations, actually later when Buddha was empty bowl with the empty bowl, so then Mara come and try to tease him. And he's asking, did you receive any food? And then Buddha say, no, I didn't receive. You did a kind of a play. So I didn't receive. Now, when the Mara want to sort of play something, then Buddha says, so I am, even though I didn't receive anything, I have no any regret, I have no any kind of a revengeful thought, angry thought, I am capable of maintaining equanimity. Pindang labheta paradattupa jeevi. Nalang tutung nopi nipachavadi. And assume that someone has offered a very raw food or undelicious food, something bitter, not something worthy. But even for that person, there is no disparage. And similarly, as I mentioned, even if someone offered something very delicious, so this particular Muni is not going to favor him excessively. He is maintaining the same kind of an attitude to everyone. So that is a very interesting point. So that's why sometimes even the kings or the merchants approach the Buddha and ask something, and he sometimes refuse it. But when as a servant girl, for example, that Punna, when come and ask and request Buddha to stay within the Jetanarame for some more time, the Buddha accept that. So you can see how Buddha maintaining that correct attitude. So he is not someone who always favored the kings. He is not someone always favored the merchants, wealthy merchants. So even he has gone to the poor villagers, he has reached even to the most underprivileged people, low caste people, and he is capable of even taking them to the sasana. That's why Sunita and Sopaka, you can understand. So they are the most underprivileged people. They are from the clan of the Shudras. So they came to the Buddha, they came to realize the Dhamma, and they even became Arahants. And now they are being respected, venerated by the kings. So a very, very interesting thing actually when we are thinking about in general. So how Buddha is making this kind of a revolutionary action. So the typical norms are the caste system in India, in particular in ancient India. So there is no way a Shudra, the lower caste person, get any kind of reverential salutation from anyone. But here when he becomes an Arahant, as a result of Buddha's teachings, as a result of his guidance, then he becomes reverential to everyone, not only humans, even to the devas. And one interesting quality that here highlighted is that how he is maintaining even-mindedness when he is going through the village Vindapada. If someone is offering something more delicious, he has no any kind of a special praise for him. And if someone is offering something not delicious, some rough food, and he is not going to disparage him, he is not going to hint him or blame him. Rather, he has the same type of compassion. So these are very, very salient features, unbelievable features, how they are maintaining this kind of an equanimity. As I said, how Venerable Kassapa was capable of maintaining such kind of an equanimity even when a leper is offering the food. It seems like he offered this maybe from his own hand. How he was capable of maintaining his mindset. So, Pangvapi Dhira Muni Vedayanta. So, they are the real measure, we can say. They are the role models of the Arahants. So, how capable, how distinguished, how venerated, worthy, how honorable they are. So, in that sense, we can understand. So, with that, I'd like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now, I'd like to offer the session, open the session for questions.
Sarai Bhante, we have 6 questions today.
Right.
Question number 1 of 6, mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, my sitting practice is mindfulness on breathing. I start focusing on the body and slowly take attention to the breath. During the first 10 to 15 minutes of observing the breath, it is not easy. My mind stays on the breath for a few seconds and jump to somewhere else. And with effort, I bring it back. This happens again and again. After a lot of effort, I start regular observations and the sensations such as touch of the airflow, hot and cold nature. Even after 3 or 4 months practice, I still have this shakiness during the start. Sometimes I feel shivering and nausea during the first 10 to 15 minutes. Should I start a technique like verbalizing in, out to get through this stage? Once this episode is over, I feel calm and relaxed. Much merits for Bhante's advice. With metta, that's the end of the question.
I think as practitioners, it's a very good, valid question, because sometimes we are sort of over-enthusiastic. Sometimes it can cause kind of anxiety, or sometimes we underestimate ourselves, and even that can happen. And again, sometimes we are expecting something, some early results, and that also can cause kind of a tension within ourselves. So likewise, there may be various reasons, and again, we don't have enough experience, and we are simply starting the practice. On such situation, we don't know how to handle the situation, and there are the hindrance power is very, very high. So there are a lot of lustful thoughts, there are a lot of angry thoughts, there are a lot of regrets, and there is doubts, and we are not yet confident about our own practice. So these all hindrances actually cause the mind to get agitated, and it may take some time to settle. So this is quite natural. So how long we are taking to settle, how long we are taking to get into the proper track, so that we are in a more steady, smooth, even type of mind situation. But anyway, don't worry. I mean, when you are more and more practicing, you become more and more confident, and you are capable, and you have your hands-on experience. Then you know how to handle things, and you know how to manage things. You already have a certain amount of experience, so you can recall what's the action that you have taken on such situation. So likewise, when you are practically doing it for a long time, so you have your own hands-on experience, and then you can overcome the problems. Therefore, what you are experiencing is quite normal to everyone, and it's a kind of a struggle at the beginning, and you need to have a lot of effort, unwavering type of effort, and again faith in order to continue. But later, as we are familiarizing with the situation, it becomes more and more easier to achieve.
Question number 2 of 7, mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, appreciate if you can explain the key differences of samatha and direct vipassana practice in the context of breathing meditation object. I do direct vipassana practice or mindfulness practice under your guidance, and it's a common observation that the breath, which we use as the meditation object, fades away once mindfulness is established. However, I have heard that this is not the case in samatha practice, where the object should be more and more stronger and illuminated. Appreciate Bhante's explanation. Much merits. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, in the samatha practice, actually, we are not emphasizing investigation. Rather, we are simply maintaining the attention at the nostril, and we are using breathing as an anchor for that. And we are simply doing kind of a superficial or glancing type of action here, not penetrating, not investigating, simply using the breathing to establish mindfulness. So when the mindfulness is established, then we are maintaining that location for a long time. So the mind get more and more collected there, more and more concentrated there. And there's a possibility of even nimitta to happen, a kind of a what we call as the counterpart sign, anapanasati nimitta, also can happen. It can manifest as a light or like a moon or something like that. And later one can use it even to go to absorptions. So that kind of a path is available in the samatha practice. But on the other hand, in the vipassana practice, we are emphasizing more and more onto the investigation, how to recognize various subtle characteristics, whether it is long or whether it is short, or whether this is the beginning, the middle, end, whether it is warm, whether it is cold. So likewise, very, very subtle characteristics we are trying to recognize from breathing. And that actually give an opportunity for the mindfulness as well as concentration as well as wisdom to develop. So not mere mindfulness, not mere concentration, but there's a more tendency for the wisdom to develop. One is paying more attention to those subtle details, trying to extract those subtle details. So this is the practical point of view. What is the initial difference between samatha and vipassana?
Question number 3 of 7. This is a general question. Venerable Sir, my question is regarding the end results of our mindfulness practice over the years of building and strengthening some non-ordinary capabilities. Venerable Sir explained them sometime back in detail during the Anapanasati Sutta, mainly about the 6 faculties, 6 bala and 7 bojjhaga. Recently, I have heard that overall these capabilities are the ones which will confront our keles and attachments to help liberate individual rather than the thinking mind. Appreciate Venerable's view that we as individuals cannot confront our accumulated keles without developing these superhuman capabilities. Much merits for your service with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I mean, we can't immediately have superhuman capabilities. And thinking of them, we don't need to sort of discourage ourselves. Actually, even when we are starting mindfulness practice, say for example, when you are doing walking meditation, there are still various keles, various defilements arising in your mind, but you are not confronting them immediately because still we are not capable. So there are still various, alternatives available. So one alternative is simply paying your attention more to the body. So what are the sensations currently I'm going through? So you are more concerned about that. So slowly, those thoughts, ruminations, and again, prapancha, proliferation, so they may fade off. They become weaker and weaker because you are paying more attention to that, the bodily sensations, bodily movements, vibrations, etc. So when we are strengthening those bodily activities, paying more attention to them, so we forget to strengthen the defilement. We forget to strengthen the prapancha. As a result of that, mind become more and more calmer, relaxed, peaceful. So even that is capable, available to a yogi who still didn't touch deeper vipassana. Of course, later when one is going through deeper vipassana, So then the mindfulness is available, clear comprehension is available, wisdom is available, and you are now fairly a capable a yogi. So then actually there is no huge difficulty for him to handle defilements, because you know, in particular in the Chittanupassana section, Buddha mentioned you don't need to worry either it is a wholesome thought or unwholesome thought. You are more concerned how they are coming and going. What are their common characteristics? Either it may be wholesome thought, either it may be unwholesome thought, doesn't matter. They all behave in a very similar fashion. So when one knows that, those unwholesome, wholesome labels become less and less effective. So for you, it is just a mere thought. And you know its common features, how it is transient, how it is coming and going. So therefore, I mean, these benefits are available throughout the practice, and we, therefore we don't need to discourage ourselves thinking that I am not capable of confronting these defilements and I am still not an arahant or something like that. Rather, from the beginning, we are strengthening that proper skills, what is necessary. And therefore, we can be happy about that.
Question number 4 of 7 is a Dhamma Sermon question. Dear sir, regarding my earlier question about faculties, Bala and Bojjhanga, when we develop these capabilities, do they grow in sequence or based on individual circumstances without a general order? Example, we can think of due to mindfulness, one becomes sharp in observations, which leads to investigation. And once that area grows, virya or energy rises to continue with the practice and so forth. Much yes. merit if Bhante can explain these capabilities, how these capabilities are linked to each other and if they are in order. With metta, that's the other question.
Yeah, actually in the Anapanasati Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya show how in order they are developed. Particularly at the early stage of our practice or in the Vipassana practice. So we have to do a kind of a systematic practice. So that is why Buddha mentioned, first of all, you need to establish mindfulness. That is where the development of the Satisambhojjhanga begins. Once the unwavering kind of mindfulness is there, then the Satisambhojjhanga is now further developing. And as a result of that, now you are starting an investigation to which that you are being mindful. Now the investigation enlightenment factor, Dhamma Vichaya, is now developing. And then you need a fair amount of effort for this, because it is not something very attractive, interesting. Rather, you yourself have to have a lot of energy to do this. As a result of that, the energy enlightenment factor, Virya Sambhojjhanga, is developing. And then when things are becoming more and more, say, fulfilled or successful, so you feel a little happy and you feel confident, and so the Piti Sambhojjhanga, the rupture, going to be developed now, because all the refinements are abandoning slowly, at least temporary, and then internal good qualities are developing. As a result of that, you get more kind of happiness. So that's how the Piti Sambhojjhanga come to the play. And then you feel confident and you are not much, very much, say, burdened, because now you are capable and mind is capable and mind know the path. So likewise, so the mind and body become lighter and lighter. So the pasaddhi, the tranquility enlightenment factor is developing. And it leads to samadhi, so the concentration or collectedness of the mind. So that is, the concentration is now developing. And ultimately, when everything is happening smoothly and you don't need to do much, so the mind itself is taking care of the whole thing. It's a matter of you taking the back seat and allow things to happen smoothly. So that is where the equanimity enlightenment factor is developing. So in it explained in a sequential order as a sequence. Therefore, we can say when bhojjhangas are developed, so they are happening in a sequence, and maybe later. So when one is, say, more capable, probably you can start from here and there. But in Anapanasati Sutta, Buddha mentioned things are in the early stages, or we can't say it is also early, but in the proper stage, so they are happening in sequence.
Question number 5 of 8, general question. Dear Bhante, while relaxing on a chair or a comfortable position, I start hearing the ringing bell sound in my ears. I feel calm and relaxed when I focus on that sound. How can I convert this to mindfulness training? Can I observe thoughts in the backdrop of these ringing bells with metta? That's the end of the question.
I think it is possible because these ringing bells or the sound of the cicadas, sound of the crickets. So likewise, people hear the sound of silence in many different forms. And actually, we don't need to worry what type of sound it is. If it is kind of a high frequency sound, very much representing that settling of the mind. So mind doesn't have much up and down right now. Mind has fairly settled. So at that moment, we may hear the sound of silence in many different ways. So while keeping that as the backdrop, probably now you can continue your typical practice. So let that sound be as it is. We don't need to worry about it. And simply we are recognizing what are the thoughts coming in, what are the sensations available, what are the element characteristics available, and we may be continuing our Vipassana practice.
Question number 6 of 8, it's a general question. Bhante, what is the meaning of Sampajanya and Yoniso Manasikara? When practicing mindfulness in the present, does one have to observe with Sampajanya and Yonasi Manasikara? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the end of the question.
Yeah. So I think Sampajanya is more, say, primary, where you start being aware of the whole situation and you are trying to investigate, trying to more recognize more detail, and you are more considerate about the situation. So these are the attributes of the Sampajanya, and it is very much related to the wisdom. Yoniso Manasikara is also wisdom, but it has the feature that it is more and more recognizing the roots, recognizing the source. So its direction is more towards finding out the reasons, causes, and recognizing the early stages, going to the source. So that is there in the Yoniso Manasikara. So Sampajanya is more general, so keeping yourself more aware, not you are sleepy or drowsy, rather you are fully aware and you have a kind of a curiosity what's really going on. So that sort of curiosity is available, and again you are trying to recognize subtle details. There's a fair relationship also, but certain fine changes or say differences also available.
Question number 7 of 8. This is a Dhammasavan question. In today's sermon, Bhante explained the Muni will accept any kind of food. Does this mean they are acting without judgment and have developed the quality of equanimity? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's the end of the
question. Yes, we can say so. But on the other hand, they have a lot of compassion, we can say. That's why, I mean, even Buddha and the Arahants, sometimes even they go village Pindapatha and they are not neglecting, omitting even the poor houses. So they even go to the very poor houses, and that is one of the vows available in the Pindapatha. We can say it's the austere practice, what we call as... there are 13 austere practices. One of them is this... going to houses in order without skipping any house. On such situation, there are, say, opportunity to receive something delicious and as well as receive something not delicious and basic raw food. So, and again, it's a very good lesson, kind of a good exercise for the monk to see how his mind reacts. Is there any kind of a desire, or is there any kind of a huge appreciation developing within oneself when something delicious is offered? Or is there any kind of a criticism or disparaging happens within oneself when something not delicious, when something raw is offered? So this is a very good exercise for the monk himself to check how mind is reacting. So the Buddha's advice and how the arahants have behaved indicate that they are capable of maintaining the equanimity on both cases. There is no any kind of a favorism for the person who is offering very good food. And again, there is no kind of an unfavorism or negligence or looking down the person, a poor person may be offering the very basic things. That indicates in a way the equanimity of the mind. Yes.
Question number 8 of 8 is the last question. It's a general question. Dear Bhante, I have a question about how to deal with people at work. I think I'm doing my best and working very hard during a busy time for my team. However, for some harder projects, I notice team members are not as interested or invested. There's no equanimity, which I try to maintain for all of our work. This makes it harder to achieve goals. I feel tired at the end of the day as I put in energy by myself to these projects. I start to feel critical and annoyed about my team and more self-critical of myself as it is harder to achieve the expectations. Appreciate your advice on how to approach such situation. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, I think it's a very valid question. As a team, when we are handling, as a monastery, when we are handling certain things, say we sometimes have to allocate certain tasks to the others. Even at the monastery, say we are allocating certain tasks, duties to the others. So when we see that others are not fulfilling their duties properly, they are not contributing 100% wholeheartedly, say you as an administrative monk or administrative person, as the team lead, probably you may feel discouraged and you feel a little angry about that person. That is very natural. So, I mean, how to maintain kind of equanimity within oneself without going to fight, without going to take revenge, or without going to blame? How to encourage them? So these are the real challenges, actually. And we recognize why they are doing so, why they are not putting 100%, and why they are not interested. Do they have any other interest? Are they skillful on some certain other activity? Suppose that I have assigned one task to one person, but he is not interested of doing that. But due to my investigation, if probably I found that he is more interested in graphic designing or something like that, so can I use him for in where he is interested? Because sometimes people are working when they are find it interesting. So their inner interest is a very valid motivation factor for them to invest more time. So what they are doing is not their own, or they are in line with their own interest, then it is very difficult for them to motivate. They internally also going through such kind of a problem. Because say you as a team lead, you didn't recognize what are the skills that these people are having. Are they contributing onto those areas which they are interested, or am I using them to some other activity which they are not interested? So these are also other things that we can consider. And on the other hand, they have their own personal problems, and that is also another area. And maybe due to personal problems that they are going through some hardships, so that is also possible. So likewise, there may be many reasons available, and it is not an easy task. To motivate everyone and to achieve the same goal is not easy. And whenever you are playing an administrative role, and whenever you are handling a department, handling a group, so always people are quite difficult, and their contribution is again not same, and therefore it's a very challenging situation. And ultimately, how are we managing ourselves? Because ultimately what we are trying to handle are the sankharas. So these sankharas are quite vulnerable, and we can't have sankharas fully under our control. So that is what we are learning through vipassana practice. So all these things are conditioned phenomena. And to the conditioned phenomena, I don't have any agreement. there is no such agreement between myself and the sankharas, the conditioned phenomena, that they should behave as I wish, even though I like that, but they don't have such kind of an agreement with me. So if I am applying my practice to this same office situation, then probably you can understand, yes, I have recognized this during my practice. So when I was observing various elements, when I was observing various feelings, when I was observing various thoughts, yes, I understood how vulnerable they are, how impermanent they are, and again, how transient they are, and how they are beyond my control. So all these things are even represented at your office. Recognize, I mean, each and every individual has different sankharas, and you can't expect everybody to behave the way you want. So they are also going through a lot of sankhara condition phenomena, and they don't sometimes have the capacity to control them. And I myself don't have the capacity to control them. On such situation, we have a little bit of acceptance into the situation. Rather than personality level, we are going to take revenge or something like that. So we have kind of an acknowledgement, yes, this is the worldly situation, this is the true situation. So we are trying to do a difficult thing. How to take everybody to the same line? It's not so easy. You can add a little bit of spiritual explanation to this, then you have a little bit of a chance to relax yourself further without taking it so serious, and again having kind of a communeness within yourself, so that you feel more lighter, you feel more relaxed, you feel kind of spacious, your heart is open, rather than restricting yourself. So these are the areas actually we can think of when you are dealing with the theme.
That was the last question, Bhante. So, so I think we can end the program for today, because Bhante is busy at the monastery, I think. So to end the program, I would like to first thank Bhante for his valuable time, to all the supporters of this program, both seen and unseen, and to the participants for joining today's program, practicing and sharing their questions. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Theruvan
Sannai. Yeah, Theruvan Sannai.